Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On a Friday, we've got international trade followed by guns and then bad air in China. Oh, yeah, and there's a storm in New York, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 8th of February. Good as always to have you with us. And we learned this morning that the trade gap, that is the difference between what we sell overseas and what we buy from abroad, unexpectedly got smaller last quarter. Two main reasons, it seems. One, higher exports, which does kind of stand to reason. Also, lower oil imports, the lowest amount in a decade, in point of fact. That kind of dip is usually bad news for an economy. Less oil used means we're working less, we're driving less, we're making less stuff. You get my drift. But that is not the whole story this time around. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro gets us going.
It's good news that oil imports are falling because it narrows the trade gap. The U.S. is spending less money on foreign crude oil, and other countries are actually buying refined oil from here. But funny thing is, they're not buying our oil from us. Amy Myers Jaffe at UC Davis explains.
So we are basically importing crude oil from other countries, refining it, using what we need, and then of the refinery output that we do not need, we're exporting that for a profit.
A Gulf Coast refinery might spin Venezuelan crude into diesel fuel and send it to Mexico. In the giant pool of oil and gas, it's hard to keep track exactly. The refineries make money on this, but it doesn't lower gas prices here. So why send refined fuel away?
Because we have no pipelines or not enough pipelines to the East Coast from the Gulf Coast to move that extra product.
John Hoffmeister is a former oil executive now running the nonprofit Citizens for Affordable Energy. He says U.S. laws and infrastructure don't allow fuel to flow freely around the country. And even though we are getting more oil out of the ground, from the North Dakota shale, for example,
it comes nowhere near eradicating the continued import of crude oil to just feed our gas tanks every day.
He says when the economy is strong, the U.S. needs about 20 million barrels of oil a day. Current U.S. oil production covers about a third of that. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
The Chicago Auto Show opens its doors to the public tomorrow, and one of the hot trends sounds more appropriate for a truck show, point of fact. Diesel engines are the new thing. They're fuel efficient, always a bonus for cash-conscious drivers. They could help automakers meet new fuel economy requirements, and they're not smelly and dirty anymore either. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith takes a look at the draw of diesel.
Chevrolet, Mazda, and Mercedes are introducing new diesel car models this year, hoping to match the success Volkswagen's had. One out of every five cars VW sold in the U.S. last year was a diesel.
It's a huge boom for diesels right now.
Luann Hammond heads drivingthenation.com.
I'm at the Chicago Auto Show, and they just brought out the Chevy Cruze diesel. Chevy has not had a diesel sedan in probably 30 years.
Why are they back? Christopher Knittle teaches energy economics at MIT. He says diesel engines get 20 to 40% more miles per gallon than gasoline cars. That appeals to both car makers and consumers.
From the consumer's perspective, the big draw of diesel is the fuel efficiency. In times of high gas prices, that becomes more and more important.
Diesel is often more expensive than gas, and diesel cars cost a little extra. But Knittle says the fuel savings usually offsets that. But diesel cars are still a tiny fraction of the U.S. market, and they have some real obstacles to overcome, says auto analyst Stephen Shork.
We can all remember back to the 1970s and those old diesel Mercedes chugging down I-95 like a Panzer tank. So really, diesel fuel has bad market memory.
Not to mention the trail of black exhaust. New diesel technology has cut those emissions, and MIT's Knittle says once you take fuel efficiency into account, diesel cars are slightly cleaner than regular models. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
I wonder if that actually was a Panzer tank. I don't know. On Wall Street today, up at the open, up at the close, we'll call that a win, and we'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll be right back. The Great Northeast Blizzard of 2013 is in full swing as a storm that shall remain nameless on this radio program anyway begins to wreak its havoc. People are, as makes some sense in a storm like this, stocking up on all sorts of supplies. We made some calls around Massachusetts today to see what's hot.
Oh my goodness, it's crazy.
We are very busy. It feels like there's a line out the door.
Everyone is in a frenzy to get their last-minute shovels and salt and traction sand.
Gloves, hats, scarves, face masks, assorted wines. I see limoncello. I see beer.
They're actually buying fire pits, which is beyond me, but I'm with the blizzard weather.
Tons of cheese. We're cutting them up by the pound.
The city essentials, the sled.
Cotswold and English cheddar.
Flashlights.
Favorite one for the cold months is a Sotto Cenere, which is a nice truffle cheese from Piedmont. Decadent, but delicious.
The batteries are scarce.
That was Karen Gwynn at the Ace Hardware in Gloucester, Mass. Nick Martinelli at the Spirited Gourmet in Belmont. And Drew O'Brien at the East Coast Alpine Sports Store in Boston. The aviation website FlightAware says the number of flights canceled in the United States from yesterday through tomorrow is now at 4,700 and climbing. And for all the passengers, business or pleasure, who've been inconvenienced, there are those for whom flying itself is a job. Sarah Cagle is a flight attendant based in Houston, Texas. She's worked in the air for 20 years now. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So what do you do when all these flights are canceled? Do you just kind of hang around?
Sometimes we do. I'm fortunate enough to be home for this one, but I know a lot of colleagues that are out there stuck right now, and some are stuck at airports. But with all the pre-cancellations, some are stuck in places like Paris.
Which is not terrible.
No, not terrible.
But if you happen to be stuck at an airport and you can't fly as a flight attendant, do you get paid, or are you just out of luck?
Well, it kind of depends. A lot depends on what airline you're with, what kind of contract you have, if you have a contract. For the most part, if you're just sitting there without being on the aircraft and the door closed, then you're not getting paid technically. However, if your flight cancels, you could be in luck and you could be pay protected.
So you know how in big storms you always hear these horror stories about airlines and airplanes getting stuck on the tarmac for like 7 hours?
Yes.
Do you get paid for those 7 hours?
If the door is closed, yes.
That's the thing. That's the key indicator, if the door is closed?
That's the key indicator.
And then do you stop getting paid when the door opens?
Correct.
That seems a little crazy, actually.
It is. It's one of those things that makes you go, hmm.
Yeah, as it just did. So lay it out for me. I mean, what's the worst scenario in a weather delay for you?
I think the worst scenario is being just the same as the passengers, being stuck on board with the door closed and not enough amenities for everybody. You know, luckily there's been some laws put into place now to protect the passengers, which also protects us. We don't really want to be stuck on there either.
So how do you deal with the cranky passengers?
Smile.
Sarah Cagle. She's got a website as well. It's called theflyingpinto.com. Sarah, thanks a lot.
Great. Thanks for having me.
What little agreement there is in the gun debate in Washington, by which I mean very little agreement, does seem to be coalescing around the idea that the main piece of legislation that's going to be proposed will be about background checks. What you have to tell the government about yourself if you want to buy a gun, and then what the government does with that information. And you know how sometimes you have to follow the money to figure out what the story is? Today, Marketplace's David Gura follows the guns.
The first gun is a pump-action Remington 870. That's the most popular shotgun ever made. I'm in Shooter's Supply in Berlin, Maryland, and the shop's owner is Bob Arthur.
It has that distinctive sound that everybody knows. You can get them in long barrels, short barrels. This one has an 18.5-inch barrel. It's compact, so you can keep it in a closet and it'd be ready for quick use.
To buy one, I'd need to fill out a 4473. That's a 6-page form from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. Name, address, social security number is optional. And there's a half a page of yes or no questions. Are you a felon? Are you an unlawful user of or addicted to marijuana? Arthur has to write down the type of gun, the make and model, the serial number. Then he calls the FBI's Criminal Justice Information Services Division in Clarksburg, West Virginia. And he gives them only the most basic information, name, address.
They give me a yay or a nay, and out the door you go. It's quick and easy. And we take credit cards.
That form, the 4473, won't go anywhere. By law, Arthur has to hold on to it for 20 years. That means the FBI doesn't have anything close to a complete record of what guns are sold. In most states, that's it. That's the background check. But this is Maryland, and say you want to buy a semi-automatic, like that AK-47 on the wall, or the Colt officer's model in the glass case.
It has 6 rounds in the mag. Every time you pull the trigger, it'll fire. This would be something that you would have to go ahead and do the extra paperwork for Maryland.
First, you'd need to show Arthur your certificate from a firearms safety training course. You can take one online in 30 minutes. Then there's a form that lets the state police check for any record of a mental disorder or violent behavior.
It's just 4 more pages of paperwork. It's just red tape.
You have to list current and past employers and 3 personal references. And the state does keep track of what you're buying.
They get the make, the caliber, the type, the finish, the barrel length, the model, the serial number, and what country of origin it was from.
You do this in quadruplicate. Arthur mails 1 copy to Maryland State Police Headquarters. This process doesn't take 2 or 3 minutes. Headquarters is in Pikesville, outside of Baltimore. Several investigators in the licensing division go through applications, checking 16 databases. By law, the state police have 7 days to do this, but Sergeant Mark Black says investigators have been extremely busy.
There is an increase in application for firearms. We are working around the clock to take care of those increases.
If Bob Arthur doesn't hear back from the state police after 7 days, Maryland law says he and the customer don't have to wait any longer. He's allowed to hand over that Colt pistol. Right now, Arthur says a state background check takes 1 month. Now, keep in mind, in most states, everything I've just described only applies to gun sales by licensed dealers. A lot of guns are sold privately. No background check, no paperwork, and no record a transaction took place. Advocates for universal background checks say they'd ensure fewer guns would end up in the hands of people who shouldn't have them, and more data would make it easier for law enforcement to trace how criminals get guns. Garen Wintemute heads the Violence Prevention Research Program at UC Davis.
If we retained centralized information, even if just on the gun itself, then ATF could follow the gun, not the purchasers, no personal identification is given up here, from that first retail purchaser through the most recent retail purchaser.
Something that's possible under state law in California, where Wintemute lives, but that's not possible nationwide. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it has 3 independent filters that match the types of air pollution that we find indoors in this environment.
Pollution as profit, but first, let's do the numbers. Well, the Bulls had a run ahead of the blizzard today. The Dow Industrials added 48 points, about 0.3%. Closed at 13,992. The NASDAQ picked up 28 points, 0.9%, finished at 3,193. The S&P 500 rose 8 points, about 0.5%, ended things at 1517. That is a new 5-year high for those keeping track. For the week, the Dow sagged 0.1%. The NASDAQ gained about 0.5%. The S&P 500 tacked on 0.3%. Technology stocks were the stars today. LinkedIn scored strong earnings, and shares of the business networking site got a 21% raise. Profits from another new media stock impressed investors, AOL, which these days is really an old new media company, dialed up 7.3%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.95%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The 137th Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show gets underway in New York. 2 new breeds compete this year, the Russell Terrier and the Treeing Walker Coonhound. 187 breeds and varieties are eligible. Former vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin turns 49. And for those of you who like butter and cream, Julia Child's cooking show, The French Chef, premiered 50 years ago. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's been kind of a funny week economy-wise. No huge news, more like burbles here and there. So we've rounded up some of the usual suspects to help us make sense of it all. Heidi Moore from The Guardian, Catherine Rampell from The New York Times, and our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Catherine, let me ask you this. We talked on the broadcast yesterday a little bit about the sequester, the looming budget cuts, and I want to get your sense on how bad, assuming it happens, how bad it might really be.
Well, from a macroeconomic perspective, in terms of, you know, like the overall economy,
yeah,
the Congressional Budget Office is saying that, you know, it would shave close to probably a percentage point off of GDP growth, which doesn't sound like a lot. But when you think about the fact that we've been under 2%
yeah,
growth for a while, that's actually quite significant.
All right. Well,
the White House today.
I was just going to say the White House today sent out this fact sheet that said bad things are going to happen. But let me ask you about your gut. What does your gut tell you?
If it happens, it's bad.
Heidi, what do you think?
I agree. I mean, why are we risking it? Maybe something bad will happen. Maybe something bad won't happen. But we know how to prevent it, which is to just stop this and come to a decision about what we're going to do about the deficit.
Yeah, you've met the Congress and the presidency of the United States, right? I mean, that's kind of not the way they do things.
No, they just like saying. to sit on their rears. But, you know, different. Let's go different.
speaking of you know, the economy, which is growing, which is adding jobs, Catherine, but we keep, I think, and this is my own theory, we keep getting whipsawed by good economic news, bad economic news, good economic news, bad economic news. What is the layman to think when he or she reads the news of the day on the business pages?
Just to bear in mind that all of these numbers get revised, that it's a very mixed picture, and we have had some bad news followed by some better news, followed by some worse news, and so on. But these are the first cuts at the numbers. You know, the GDP number that we got last week that a lot of people were panicking about, showing that the economy shrank in the fourth quarter, is probably going to get revised upward. You know, we've had a bunch of new reports come in since then that suggest that things were not quite as bad. So, you know, it looks like even though the picture is confusing, it's probably more of the same. It's a lot of this sort of steady but mediocre growth, both on the jobs front and the output front.
Heidi, are you as sanguine as Ms. Rampell?
I'm sanguine because you just can't put that much stock in economic numbers. As Catherine mentioned, they get revised all the time. The methodology, how they're created, is notably problematic. But what they do tell us, the fact that it's up and down and up and down, what that tells us is that it's a weak economic recovery. This we know. I mean, if it is a recovery at all, it is definitely weak. And that means, of course, that we shouldn't threaten it. We should be trying to strengthen it. And we don't see a lot of those initiatives happening to strengthen the economy. And I don't know why we gave up on that.
Well, did we give up, Catherine, so much as it just yielded? Any attempts to get the economy going again yielded to the inertia of American politics?
I would say that there are two things going on. One is that there is a disagreement in Washington about what the economy needs. I think there's less disagreement amongst economists about what the economy needs. But, you know, you do have a lot of Tea Party types, very conservative types in office right now who believe that cutting the deficit, cutting federal spending is the way to get the economy going. I mean, Keynesian economists would disagree with that. But you do have some ideological basis for some of the disagreement. And then you also have the political stasis right now, right, that everybody's sort of playing chicken to try to get what they want and in the process wreaking a lot of havoc in the private sector.
All right, Heidi, here's the question of the day as we go out. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about the Weather Channel naming storms and this whole Nemo thing?
This is very upsetting.
Okay.
I am very disappointed in Nemo. I think we blew a great opportunity. It should have been at least Merlin, because Merlin the Blizzard is kind of great, right?
Oh,
or Gandalf. Gandalf the Blizzard. But it definitely shouldn't be Nemo. Of course, we know that Nemo has a grand Latin history. But more importantly, we picture it as an adorable little fish.
A stupid little fish.
All right,
we're done. Catherine Rampell from The New York Times. Heidi Moore from The Guardian. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Just about the only fun part of doing your taxes, and a very small fun part at that, is imagining how you might spend your refund. But before any splurging happens, there is social science research to contend with. The 1.2 million people who use TurboTax might see some hints encouraging them to save some of their refund this year. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
The average refund last year was about $2,800. It's like a bonus paycheck or a surprise inheritance.
Many people, when they get that refund check, it's their one day of the year of solvency.
Richard Thaler is an economist at the University of Chicago. He says we should jump on this moment.
By making it as easy as possible to take some of that money and save it.
And that's the idea behind this experiment. People who use Intuit's free TurboTax will see their refund amount. And at the same time, a suggestion of how much of it they should save. It might say something like, have a family or thinking about starting one? Start planning a bright future for them. Researcher Michal Grinstein-Weiss with Washington University in St. Louis says this is the golden moment, when you know the amount, but you don't have it in your hot little hands yet.
And that's the moment when they need to decide what they're going to do with it. And that's what when we are intervening.
She wants to see if her prompts will increase savings. But wait a minute. We just came through a financial crisis that in the end didn't do very much to increase savings. So will this really work? Harvard professor Bridget Madrian says, actually, this experiment has a better strategy than the crisis.
If you got an email in your inbox that said, financial crisis is happening, do you want to save more, click here, that would lead to bigger behavioral changes than just people watching it on the television.
We'll have to keep that in mind for next time. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
In the past couple of weeks, the following things have happened to the air over eastern China. It has become A, noticeable from space, because it is B, essentially opaque with pollution. It is C, affecting government policies on fuel standards and factory utilization. And it is D, becoming a handy way to make money, our China correspondent Rob Schmitz reports.
You can tell a lot about a place from a dinner party. In L.A., the banter around the table gravitates around traffic and driving routes. In D.C., beltway politics. And in Beijing and Shanghai, more and more dinner guests are asking each other, so what kind of air filter do you have?
The most popular machine is the HealthPro 250.
Oliver Moore shows me an air filtration machine the size of a small refrigerator. He heads the Shanghai office for IQ Air.
What it has is three independent filters that match the types of air pollution that
IQ Air machines have become air filtration status symbols in China. They're efficient, they're made in Switzerland, synonymous with clean alpine air, and at $1,600 a pop, they're not cheap. But when a toxic cloud the size of Alaska engulfed China's eastern seaboard, price became irrelevant. People just wanted to breathe air that wasn't full of carcinogens.
Instead of, 15 to 30 people contacting our office a week, it may have doubled and in some cases tripled.
IQ Air has sold out of its units in China. Orders are on a two-week backlog. Bad air has also meant that other companies in China that formerly had nothing to do with cleaning up the air are suddenly shifting their business strategies. Sino Textiles CEO Zhao Danqing opens up his company's newest product, a plaid cloth face mask with a removable filter.
Last year, when the air over northern China started to get really bad, we produced a huge number of masks and launched an aggressive marketing campaign.
It was around the time when PM2.5 became a buzzword in China. The term refers to pollution particles small enough to enter your bloodstream. The air over Beijing has been full of them lately. Zhao's company, which typically makes underwear and sportswear, bought the trademark for the name PM2.5, and now his masks are among the top sellers in China.
2 weeks ago, when the air was really bad, our website crashed from all the traffic.
But for some, masks and filtration machines just don't cut it. For around $250,000, you can buy a clean air dome to put over your backyard, giving it the look of a football stadium. Xiaolong sells those.
We've had calls from rich people who want to cover up their backyards so they can exercise on polluted days.
Xiaolong heads Broadwell Technologies. For years, the company specialized in building covered domes so that sports fields could be used in the winter.
We've received dozens of calls a day from schools and government bureaus in charge of sporting events that want to buy our domes.
An international school in Beijing has bought two of Xiao's clean air domes, and orders are piling up from other cities, he says. Just months ago, Xiao managed 40 people. He'll have a staff of 200 handling all this new business come springtime. It's an industry with a seemingly endless horizon in China, as long as that horizon is obscured by charcoal gray smog. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
If you haven't seen what it looks like yet, we've got pictures of all that Chinese pollution on our website. It's marketplace.org. And while you're there, a smog simulator, what your city would look like with Beijing's air. And here's a hint, you are not going to see a whole lot of skyline.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today in which I opine against the use of storm names that the Weather Channel dreams up. One would hope the sheer commercialism and profit-driven motivation would be clear enough, but in case it's not, two examples from the Weather Channel's website should seal the deal. One, they say, quote, in today's social media world, a name makes it much easier to reference in communication. In other words, storms need a Twitter hashtag. Number two, the next name after Nemo is Orko, which, and correct me if I'm wrong, somebody please, is a character from the Masters of the Universe cartoon franchise. I mean, come on, right? All right, we're done. That's Marketplace on a Friday from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 48 points, about 0.3%. The NASDAQ picked up 28 points, 0.9%. The S&P 500 up 8 points, 0.5%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. JJ Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, at some point, a guy's got to decide, man purse or no man purse.
All the medications, electronica, and personal care items for me and my kids, and even cargo pants offer too little space.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're out of here. We'll see you Monday. Have a great weekend. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.